Hello, my name is Monty Rowland, and I'm the president of the RTP Product Development Guild, and I'm also the president of Monty Design. And when that doesn't keep me busy enough, I'm the president of the local chapter of the PDMA, it's the Carolinas chapter. And what I wanted to talk to you about tonight was product design, especially as it relates to what's called the fuzzy front end. The fuzzy front end is a term that a lot of people who aren't deep in the industry look at you and go, "The what?" And it's an important part of the design process. And what I'd like to do is spend the next few minutes talking about the fuzzy front end and talking about it in terms of how different companies make it happen, and what they do, and how our firm does it, and how the guild does it, and kind of tie all that together. The fuzzy front end is the part of the project when you design a product. So when you design a product, you have this wide range of activities, all of which are very, very important. It's kind of like if you have a stool and you take a leg away, then the stool falls down. And it's the same thing with product design. The thing that a lot of people don't realize is that in the case of products, sometimes the stool leans way, way over. And you want the stool to stand up as straight as you can so you sell as many products as you can. And you do that by meeting needs of your customers or your clients. In the fuzzy front end, the emphasis is placed on defining the product and working through what the product should be, finding that vision and the vision of the person who's pushing this product forward. You know, I think that all good products, and if you think about good products, what is a good product? So I'm spreading out here, and we'll try to tie it back together as we go. A good product is a product that sells, at least in terms of good for the manufacturer. A good product can also be a product that is just loved by the consumer or by the customer or the user. And unfortunately, a product having a cult following doesn't always guarantee success in the marketplace. A good example of this is Apple. Apple has products that have a huge following, and before the iPod really didn't have all that great a success in the marketplace compared to other products that often had less of a devoted following and maybe a lot of times detractors, but sold more products and generated more profit for the company that made them. And of course, what I'm referring to is the PC versus the Macintosh. So in the fuzzy front end, you want to think about the product in terms of this holistic picture. Not only do we want to have a product that has a cult following like the Macintosh, we also want to try to design a product that is going to sell well. So in the fuzzy front end, what we try to do is to define the holistic product. Now, in a lot of organizations, things like how we're going to sell the product or how we're going to market the product or even how we're going to manufacture the product is something that's pushed off until the end. Now, organizations that I'll argue that do better over the long haul are organizations that consider how the product is sold, is marketed, is distributed, is repaired. All these things are critical to the long-term success of the product. when you think about a fuzzy front end project, it's important to lay out kind of the terrain here. The first important part of our terrain is that we define the area that we're going to play in, and that is finding that vision. And usually, successful products have one or a small group of people who have this common vision. I think as the group gets larger, it gets more and more difficult to have a common vision. So a lot of times, I think products that are truly successful are products where one person's vision got them there. It was a strong vision, and it worked, and resulted in a good product. So first thing is we want to define the vision. Now, it's difficult in any environment to take a vision and get that down on paper, because it's very, very easy to destroy the vision in the process of writing it down, because you start throwing stuff out. And this is one of the reasons that true brainstorming is kind of difficult, because the first thing we want to do is throw out ideas that don't work. So the first thing we want to do in defining this product is to get this vision down. What it capture that vision, no matter how crazy that may seem, or it may be an extreme vision, but that vision came from somewhere. And sometimes there's magic there, and I say magic, there's no, but there's that clarity of thought is probably a better way to put it. So we want to capture that vision. Once we capture that vision, then what generally happens is that someone starts writing a spec or specification for the product. Now, one of the things that's important is to also do something called voice of the customer. And voice of the customer is a critical part of the defining a product and the fuzzy front end. And voice of the customer is where you go out and you do interviews. The people on your team, and I think it's important for my professional opinion is it important for people on the design team to do interviews, because sometimes you can talk about something, write about something, but once you start interacting with other people and discussing it, sometimes there's a whole other level of understanding that comes about. So in voice of the customer, you sit down and you start out with a scripted interview. And the scripted interview is questions, because you want to have some questions that you want everybody that's doing interviews to ask. So in the case of a guild team is seven people. So you've got seven people going out doing interviews. Now, it doesn't take a tremendous amount of interviews to get to where you've got a statistically significant result. If you're doing good quality interviews, then you can get there pretty quickly. So let's say that we assign three interviews per team member. Now, if people go out two by two, I think that's a good idea that maybe they do six interviews between them. And going out two people at a time is another good way to do that, because one person asks questions and one person listens and watches, because sometimes body language tells you an awful lot. But in voice of the customer, there's start out with an assumed set of questions, and those set of questions are going to ask about existing products and what do you like about the existing products, and there's some assumptions about this product, and maybe ask some questions about the vision for the product. The one thing the voice customer is not is that most of the time it's pretty much impossible to explain a vision to someone and have someone go, oh, okay, and then give you good feedback on that vision. I think a lot of times someone needs a prototype of that vision, be it a physical part, or if it's a service, maybe you've mocked up some service, or you're role-playing, or what have you. But so it's hard to extract vision from other people during your voice of the customer interviews. So I think that one of the goals is to ask questions. Now, where the gold and the nuggets come from is when people give you information you didn't know, but it's critical information. So for example, let's say that you're interviewing not a user, but let's say you're interviewing someone in purchasing at a company that buys a similar product. Well, they may tell you that the biggest reason that they don't buy this product is because they need a 24-pack, and it only comes in a 13-pack. But if they buy a 13-pack, they end up throwing one away every time because they have to stock it in multiples of 12. That is an arbitrary example, but if you take that example and then say, well, we need to do a 24-pack, then that one thing might give a significant advantage in the marketplace. And so knowing that one thing, you design around that. Now, of course, you always have to filter, because you do with voice of the customer interviews, with having, especially if you have a small number, you do always run the risk of someone anecdotally biasing your what you think you know, your assumptions. And maybe everybody else in the world really wants a 13-pack. It's just this one hospital because they're using, you know, an old pack holder from 1960 and they don't want to get rid of it. But so you always have to, you know, be careful that you're how you filter out the information you get. But at the same time, you may get a piece of information that's amazingly valuable to your product. So with voice of the customer, you want to interview people from the purchasing agent to the installer to the end user, anybody that is a stakeholder in this product, and the stakeholder being anyone that, say in this case, we've got a, let's assume we've got a competitive product we're looking at competing against, anyone that uses that competing product, or anyone that purchases it, or anyone that has to stock it. Those are all stakeholders in that product, which is a little different than stakeholders in the project. So stakeholders in the project are the people who have a role in the project and who this product's important to, because they're either supporting the project or they're directly involved. But what we're looking for here is that people who are involved in the industry we're designing for. So after you take the voice of the customer interviews and you write them up and share them between the group, then you start getting a better picture of the product. The lack of good information often hurts products and product lines, because there's an opportunity that's missed. When, let's go back to Apple. We'll pick on Apple a little bit, or actually praise them here. When you look at the iPod and ask yourself, why did the iPod succeed? Was it because of the wheel that you could navigate through? Was it because of how it looked? Was it because of how it felt? Was it, you know, some throwback to the, you know, the cult, almost cult fanaticism of the Macintosh and Apple users? And I don't think that's it. I don't think people would go buy an MP3 player just because they like the computer. There are other MP3 players that are very attractive. And granted, the Apple one is simple and clean, which contributes to it. There's, you know, the interface was just awesome. And it was totally different. And it was amazingly well worked out. So when you take your Apple and you run it through with a scroll wheel, scroll wheel works great. So much so, if there's any problems at all with the scroll wheel, it's assumed to be completely defective. Whereas other MP3 players, I'd argue, if you have a dome switch that's not always working, you might think maybe it's you, or it's not totally defective. But with the Apple, the interface is so good that once you have one that starts skipping or doing something like that, you notice it instantly, because you've got such a, you've been used to such a high quality interface. So somewhere in here, Apple did something right. Now, I would argue that one of the things that's really made the Apple iPod work is that they came up with a program called iTunes. And iTunes did a couple things for you. One is it gave you a very, very easy way to sync your iPod. It also gave you a way to update the firmware on your iPod. And just updating firmware is something that most people would never do. It's such a pain. But with Apple, when they update firmware, it lets you do it right there semi-automatically. It prompts you, and if you say yes, it updates the firmware. You could also buy songs, and you could also manage your music collection. Now, I really have not been a big fan of how Apple manages the music collection personally, but there's a lot of people that have their entire collection there. So iTunes helped, and Apple went a step farther, and they used a compression protocol that wasn't an MP3 one. So even though an Apple will play an MP3 a song or a title, it uses a different compression. So they did their homework there. Now, so don't lose your own terminology here. MP3 is just a scheme by which, or an algorithm by which, music or spoken word, for example, what you're listening to now, is compressed in an attempt to, when you uncompress it and listen to it, you want it to sound as much like the original. So you want this to sound like you're sitting here in the truck with me while I'm talking to you. Apple used a different type of compression other than the MP3 standard to try and achieve a higher quality. So there again, they did their homework. They looked at this holistically. They came late to a market. I mean, there was a lot of MP3 players already out there. And they came in, not the first one, not a pioneer, but they came to a market late and just crushed everybody sales-wise. So what Apple did was is they looked at this as an entire product. And this is one of the things you want to do in the fuzzy front end, is you want to look at your product holistically. You get the voice of the customer. You look at how you're going to sell it, how you're going to distribute it. You know, these are all things that are critical because they affect how it performs before it even gets to the user, how it performs in the marketplace and getting it to the user. So you don't want to neglect that. And all these items that come together, you know, thinking about, you know, maybe even legal things, financial, materials, engineering, all these things get put together and then push the product forward. Unfortunately, this exercise that we're talking about at the fuzzy front end often gets neglected. And it doesn't just get neglected in startups or by entrepreneurs. It gets neglected in big companies too. Somebody who's overworked and a product manager, they do a few interviews and they ask some questions. They're pretty sure they got the next product nailed down. But at the same time, that can be a recipe for disaster. I've seen places where the product manager was, you know, basically basing a product on what one place had worked. The product manager was basing a product on what current customer had requested and what he thought another customer wanted. And so, you know, you kind of wondered where the rest of the industry was. You know, by basing a product that, you know, a company's going to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to develop on input from two entities is a risky endeavor. So what we've talked about doing here, this fuzzy front end process, is often skipped. It's very often skipped at the entrepreneurial level or at the startup level because there's this emphasis on getting the product done and getting it out there. So it's very, very tempting and very, very easy to just skip right over that. When that happens, then it may make it more difficult to sell the product. All this work may be for naught because it may sales channel wants, or it may not be something that a big enough customer base wants. So that's definitely a risk by skipping the fuzzy front end. If the fuzzy front end is done right, and you've gotten input across a wide variety of individuals and groups and stakeholders, and then and condense that down into information that you can then use to design the product. Fuzzy front end doesn't as much design the product as it does. It illuminates where the design needs to go. Now, you know, a lot of times there's the opportunity to go ahead and do part of lay the groundwork for the product. So some of that initial design is done and then followed up with detailed design later on. So that's kind of how the fuzzy front end works. I hope that it's you know, clarified a few things, and I hope this was clear. I know we're kind of talking about some abstract concepts, and I hope this was enjoyable to listen to and educational. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to drop me an email, and have a great day.